Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at the Dave Kubiak Door County Mystery Series. You know, when the latest and now last book came out, I saw it in the bookstore, and I got to grab that right away. So I grabbed it, and then I proceeded to sit down and read it, and I didn't quite make it through one sitting. It was kind of later in the day when I got my hands on it, but I did. I get through it on the second sitting, and I was kind of sad in a way about it ending. But maybe you don't know about the whole series, so let's talk about the whole series with our guest, who is the author of that series, Patricia Skalka. She's the past winner of the Midwest Book Award, the Edna Ferber Fiction Award, and her new book is called Death Casts a Shadow. So, are you a fan of the Door County Mystery Series? I hope you'll join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Patricia Skalka, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Oh, nice to be here, Larry, and thanks for having me again.
Yeah, you and I have been chatting,
I think, probably
each book about seven times or so. And you announced that this was going to be the last in the Dave Kubiak series, at least. And maybe for those who aren't familiar with it, talk about the narrative throughout the books, because it evolves over time, for sure.
It does, and it starts with Dave at age 42. The first book was Death Stalks Door County, and the Kubiak is in a very bad spot at that point in time. He's lost his wife and daughter to an accident that he felt he could have prevented or should have prevented, and you know, he's just laden with grief and guilt, and he comes to Door County to escape his past, to escape his life, to escape everything, and doesn't even want to be there. He's retrained as a park ranger, and he's kind of hiding out in Peninsula State Park. He's like the one person in Door County who wants to leave, and everybody else loves it and is trying to figure out how to stay. And he's given himself basically a year, and people start dying in mysterious ways. He was a homicide detective in Chicago. He knows something's going on. Of course, he's the guy who figures it out and solves it, but he has to deal with his own demons. And I initially thought I was writing just a standalone. And as I was working on it, I realized that there was the potential for a series. You know, other ideas kept coming to me. And then I realized that I couldn't leave this man in this place. He was broken. He was 42 years old. And if I was going to write a series, I had to help him somehow. And the only way I could figure out to do that was to move him through time so that life would change, circumstances would change. So at the end of the first book, he's elected sheriff. And then, of course, he's sheriff through the rest of the series. And we follow him for a period of 20 years. So writers like to talk about story arcs, the beginning, the middle, the end of the story. So each book, it has its own story arc. Each one is a self-contained mystery. And the overriding story arc of the series is Kubiak's journey, his beginning, his middle, and then how he finally is back, kind of reconnected with life and with himself.
Yeah. I'm glad you did it that way. I can remember our first conversation on that first book, and I'm sure I told you I didn't like him very much.
he wasn't a very likable person initially. He was pushing people away deliberately. I mean, that was his defense mechanism. He'd forgotten how to trust. He felt abandoned by life. He felt he was just a lost soul. And yeah, he wasn't, and he was drinking way too much. And as I said, he was just trying to hide out. He didn't want to interact with anybody. But that slowly changed over time.
Yeah, it did indeed. And you grew to, at least I did, and I'm sure other readers did too, just grew to kind of like the guy a lot and always kind of root for him, you know, a little bit.
That's exactly what happened. And it was a surprise to me. I mean, I would get emails from people asking if Kubiak, is he okay? You know, and saying how much they liked him and how much his story reflected their own struggles. That's what really touched me. People saw themselves in Kubiak and they saw his dealing with loss and trauma as realistic. You know, we live in a society where there's an easy solution to everything, or at least, you know, we'd like to think there is. And that doesn't quite happen when you have an experience, a loss like Kubiak had. That stays with you. It lingers and it affects you through life. And people who've had those kinds of losses and situations saw that in him and recognized their own stories in his struggle. It was very moving when I would get these emails from people who would tell me this and share some of their own lives.
I can imagine it would have been. And, you know, one of the approaches that you took that I liked, at first I thought, oh, wait a minute. But here it goes over 20 years and you had 7 stories. So there's probably about 2 or 3 years between each story so that things have changed a fair amount by the next book.
Yes, you know, it's just the way I did it. Some people said, you know, we wish there'd a little bit been a few more fill-ins, you know, tracking the story in a different way and maybe more detail, which would have meant more books. But somehow, you know, you as a writer, you just go with what works for you, and this is what worked. And so that's the way I did it.
Yeah, well, I liked it. At first I thought, oh, I would have liked to have known about the wedding or whatever. But then I thought, no, I didn't need that. I really didn't need that. It's always interesting to hear about the origins for a book. And let's talk about this particular installment. What was the inspiration for this story?
Well, as you know, in each book, I always have something that's happening in the present that is connected to something that happened in the past.
Yeah.
So I needed the two tracks. And the one track is about a woman who's wealthy and widowed and who is involved in a relationship that occurs online and seems quite legitimate for all sorts of very logical reasons. And, but I've been reading about especially women who are victimized in these kinds of scams. And it just made me really, really angry, that this kind of thing happens. And so I wanted to use a story like that, but I had to tailor it to meet the circumstances of what I was writing about. So as I say, for all intents and purposes, it appears to be totally legitimate and authentic. And then I needed to have something from the past. And that's where I, you know, look at the history of the place. And you know, Door County was originally part of the frontier. It was very rough and tumble. Fortunes were made. Fortunes were lost. People were cheated. There wasn't a lot of regulation and law. And so I dipped into that to develop the other part of the story. And then all the other pieces kind of slowly came into place. There are many, many, that's the thing with writing a mystery. It's like a 70,000 word puzzle because you have to get it all to fit together smoothly.
Yeah, it does. it fits together very, very well. I will say that for sure. And it was, you know, a part of it, maybe not the main one, but the relationship between Dave and his son, and there are some trust issues there, I think, between Dave and his son, the older women, their employees, the online scam. Do you think we as a society trust too much?
I don't think we trust enough.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the, well, I see what you're saying. I mean, yes, women, if you just blindly believe something that comes across, But like, you know, someone is reaching out to you on the internet and you believe everything they say. So yes, to an extent, we do trust too much. And I think it's because we have a need that's not filled. You know, someone tells you you're wonderful. Someone, it says something. It sells your soul in some way. But my character, you know, she was doing her due diligence. She wasn't just gullible. She had a reason to sincerely believe that this was an authentic relationship. And it wasn't, you know, she wasn't being naive, but still there were things she could have done. You know, there were ways she could have, steps she could have taken to protect herself. So yes, in a sense, we do trust too much. I think we tend to trust, we trust what we want to hear. We believe what we want to hear. And that's what something that we as a society have to work on.
But then you said you don't think we trust enough and other aspects. Explain that.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of Kubiak and the way he started, not trusting people, not really trusting himself. You know, there was in one of the books along the way when he has remarried and then he finds out that his wife is pregnant and he does not trust himself to be a father again. And it's a huge crisis for him. And how is he going to handle this? And he comes up with all kinds of excuses about why she shouldn't be pregnant. She'd had many miscarriages in her previous marriage. No, your health is in danger. And, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. And for all kinds of reasons. But what he finally had to acknowledge to himself was that he did not feel that he could be a father because he felt he had failed so miserably the first time. So he didn't trust himself. So I think that's where I'm talking about trust and learning to trust people who really are there for you. Like he had to learn to trust Evelyn Bathard, the coroner, to trust him. You know, this is a man who's offering him friendship and, in fact, kind of evolves into the role of a father figure. But, you know, Kubiak treaded lightly there. He wasn't going to just grab that hand that was held out to him. It took a while. So we don't trust people that we're faced with, you know, who are there and genuine, but we trust these anonymous voices, or words that come across the internet, which doesn't make any sense.
Patricia Skalka, our guest today, she is the author of the latest in the Dave Kubiak series, Death Casts a Shadow. And she's going to be with us right up till 12:30. We'll get you involved, too. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Questions for Patricia about her writing or about the book and series itself. I hope you'll join in. You can also email to ideas@wpr.org. Larry Mueller will be back right after the news. If you're looking for a good book to take on your next vacation, I have one for you here. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Patricia Skalka, is the author of the Dave Kubiak Door Counting Mystery Series, and we'll be continuing to talk with her about the latest edition, Death Casts a Shadow. Maybe you're already a fan of the series. What questions do you have for Patricia, either about the series or maybe about writing? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Patricia, why'd you choose to set the story in winter?
Well, I decided at the beginning, if, you know, I told you I thought it was going to be a standalone Death Stalks Door County.
Yeah.
And then I started getting more ideas, and I thought, well, there would be four of them, one a season. And somehow it just seemed logical that winter would be the final. It would end in winter. And then as the series started to expand, as I kept coming up with more ideas, I still had that idea in my mind that winter would be the final book. And none of the others, I mean, they're all set in spring, summer, fall. This is the only one. Winter just somehow seemed to be the place to end it.
Does the time of year inform your books in some fashions?
To a certain extent, yes, because it it kind of dictates what is available, what's there, what happens, what the scenery is like. That whole description of Sturgeon Bay frozen over with the path cut down the middle for the freighters to come in. I mean, I saw that one time in like March, or I was up there in February or March, and it saw it from up about three stories up, and it was just stunning. You know, I had this all this white snow, frozen ice covered with snow, and the little fishing huts and everything. I mean, I had that mental image in my mind, and I knew I had to use that at some point in time. So, the seasons do dictate. They dictate how many people are there. They dictate how busy the sheriff's department is. Lots of things revolve around the seasons.
They do indeed. I wonder, you know, I've been stuck. I've been in a remote area in the wintertime. In the National Forest, it's been in the dark. And it's... it can be kind of scary. It's a weird experience, and you do a great job of describing it. Matter of fact, I kept thinking, I wonder if he's going to get lost when he was tramping through the woods in the dark with the wind blowing hard and the snow coming down. You did a really good job of describing it. Have you experienced it yourself?
Driving in winter up in,
or walking through the woods in winter?
Walking through the woods. I remember one time, this was years back, my grandmother had a farm in north central Wisconsin, and we used to go up there and we would go snowmobiling. And my cousin took me out at night, and we went through fields and pastures and such. And then we ended up in the woods, and it was like all birch trees. And he turned off the engine of this thing, and the silence.
Yeah,
and it was just overwhelming, and it was kind of scary. And even though I knew where we were, it all looked different. So it would be very easy to be lost in something like that.
I've spent time in Door County in the winter, done some a little bit of cross country skiing and a little snowshoeing. Do you enjoy, or what do you love about Door County in the winter?
Well, I like the fact that it's quiet and kind of. It's more peaceful. I mean, it's very peaceful, except, I mean, when there are a lot of tourists in the summer. Some of the towns get pretty busy. But I just like the relaxed, laid-back atmosphere of it and the beauty of it. You know, it's just so stunning to go through, like, Peninsula State Park and see all that snow and look out at the frozen bay and everything. And it's a different kind of world. It just changes dramatically from summer and the warmer months into winter. And it has its own appeal, and I like that.
You feature a few sculptures of Frederick Remington in the book, In Death Casts a Shadow. And I've always enjoyed those Remingtons, looking at them or seeing photos of them. I don't think I've seen some copies, kind of, but I've never seen the real thing in person. But why did you choose the Remingtons?
Well, there's one character who I needed a character who had an art collection, and he was a man who had been sort of a small time robber baron around the turn of, you know, the early 1900s. And I kept thinking, well, what would he collect? You know, what would appeal to him? And the timing, and I always liked the Remingtons too. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated by the fact that someone can make something so delicate and fragile looking out of, you know, metal, and the whole business of how they're formed. So I thought, that's the perfect thing. That's what this character would have wanted to collect. And he would have had the money. I mean, he bought one in like 1909 or something for like $2,000, which is, you know, it was an enormous amount of money back then. And he could afford it. So that's how they got into the book. And I also thought, well, that would be just something very visual that I think a lot of people could relate to. And in fact, it has turned out to be that way. Some people who didn't know anything about them say, wow, I learned a lot. And other people talk about, oh, you know, someone they knew had a copy of this, or they'd seen one of the Remingtons in a museum. So it really does kind of ring a bell with people.
And you had the person die while holding one.
Yes. Well, this is true, too.
Oh, my goodness. You added a birding element to your story this time around. Are you a birder?
I am not a birder, but I live in Milwaukee near Lake Park, and I see people birding, and I'm intrigued by it. And I have friends who've done this for years, and I'm sort of thinking in the back of my mind that, you know, maybe this is something I would like to get into. So I was curious, too, about how this would, you know, how birds would survive in the wintertime. And one thing led to another, and there's a birds, like a sanctuary for exotic birds of prey in Door County. So they offered me, I contacted the director there and said, you know, well, what do you need to keep birds going in winter in Door County? And he basically described what his bird feeders were like and the kind of feed he used and everything and why it was important and why water, they really need water. You know, everything's frozen. They have to have a way of getting drinkable water. So that was kind of part of it too. So I was trying to mix a lot of different elements in people's interests, you know, so one character who collected Remingtons, another one is a dedicated birder, and somehow all these paths and lives cross and intersect.
It's really, really cool. And that, you know, sort of the, I don't know, makes you think about it a little bit for Door County. There's the, and you sort of hit on it a little earlier, of the economic disparity that can exist in Door County?
Well, it does exist in Door County. It exists, I think, just about everywhere. But the you know, there's a housing shortage for workers and for people who you know, just are seasonal workers, and that's an issue up there, and it's an issue just about everywhere you can imagine. And the disparity, as I said, you know, goes back in this story anyway, goes back in time to things that happened, you know, generations ago, where, as I said, you know, fortunes were made and lost, and people were sometimes cheated out of something that they thought they were entitled to. So, and these are like roots that then percolate up through the soil to the present time.
Yeah, and so we have people who are quite poor, and to some extent, kind of not their own fault. I mean, they're sort of a victim of some circumstances that were nefarious, I guess you could say.
Yeah, but it's also a question of, well, how much responsibility do you then have for yourself? You know, obviously they started out at a disadvantage, but you know, if you keep feeding on that, it just grows and grows and resentment and whatever. But yeah, and then I think other people who are more privileged through no result of their own work or endeavors, they're just kind of born into it, you know, with a silver spoon. I think they need to be reminded that, hey, there but for the grace of God, you know, go you. But not anybody else. You know, you just lucked into it, and maybe you have some responsibility to be aware of that and to act accordingly, and not to just feel totally entitled. Because I think it's easy to feel entitled.
You're absolutely right about that. Well, Dave is at a much better place. Certainly, you leave Dave in a much better place than when we met him, for sure. We've kind of talked about that. But what helped him get over the loss of his wife and child?
That's a really excellent question. I think what, in a sense, time helps. Time doesn't, it's not magic, and it doesn't erase anything, but it helps to soothe the pain. And he learned, well, for one thing, he reconnected with his profession. He had a purpose in life that was connected to who he was and what he had done. He was a homicide detective. And so he found a new direction when he became sheriff and a new role in life, returning to what he had been like. And then personally, it was a question or a matter of learning to be comfortable with where he was, what he was doing, the people around him, learning to trust again. There's a scene, a paragraph that I really, really like that is in the third book, Death in Cold Water, where he rescues what he thinks someone has thrown a bag into the bay, and he's out fishing, and he hears a noise, and he thinks there's a baby in this bag, and he jumps in and saves it. He ends up rescuing a litter of kittens, newborn kittens, and he's driving them back to his house. He has them on the passenger seat with the heater on and everything, and he's telling them that he was out there because he didn't want to see the game that afternoon because it was the Bears, in Chicago, and playing the Packers, and he didn't want to see the skylight. He didn't want to be reminded of his old life. But he talked about growing into his second skin, like they would be growing into their little kitten bodies, and how the second skin, this new person that he was becoming, didn't always fit comfortably, but but he was trying. And so I thought it was just, I don't even know where that came to me to have him talk about, something like that to the kittens, but he was reassuring them that they would be okay, even as he was kind of reassuring himself that, okay, I'm not quite there yet, but I'm getting there. It's a slow process. And what he learned ultimately was that it never goes away. And he saw that through the experience with Guithard and different people. It doesn't go away, but you learn how to live with it. You learn how to live with the loss. You don't forget it. You don't close a door on it. It doesn't disappear.
Is it tough to leave him, by the way?
Oh, it was a very bittersweet decision to know. But I knew he was in a good place, so I knew it was time to leave. But yeah, I think about him. I imagine him getting together with Guithard, and they're at Pecta's, and they're having lunch, and Amelia, who's kind of, a curmudgeon in her own right, is taking their order, and they're just kind of enjoying themselves and talking about what's going on. And he's connecting, of course, with his son and looking forward to the boy growing up. Joey now is 13, and Kubiak sees that he has a job to do. He has a job to be a good father. He's been a good father to this child up until this point, and that job is going to continue.
Yeah. Before this series, you were a nonfiction writer.
Yes.
When did you have to learn or maybe unlearn to write in order to write fiction?
Well, I think I had to use some of the skills I learned as a nonfiction writer because I knew how to do research. I knew how to meet deadlines. When you get edited, you develop a thick skin. I mean, I wrote for the Reader's Digest, and boy, they have it, it was like slash and burn. That's how they edit. So you had to learn to not take things personally. And also, I interviewed a lot of people who'd had traumatic experiences. I wrote personal feature stories, and that helped me in understanding people and motives and actions, and that helped in developing characters. I also knew the concept of the full circle. You start with an issue or a problem or a challenge, and you take the story all the way around, and you answer that. And in a mystery, you solve the mystery, you solve the problem, but you also deal with all the other issues that are affecting your characters. And one of the things, if I may bring this up, is that several years ago, when the pandemic was kind of raging and people weren't traveling or you really couldn't travel, USA Today did a special feature. They chose one book to represent every state, 50 books, 50 states. The idea was, okay, you can't travel, but you can go places through reading. And the book they chose for Wisconsin was Deathstalks Door County. It was stunning. I don't know how that happened, but it was really an amazing thing to me that they chose that book to represent the state.
That's great. I hope it sold some more books for you.
Well, I think so.
Do you ever get writer's block, or is there a time in your writing that, this is a rough patch here? And if you do, how do you get around it?
Well, one of the things, I always think through the story from beginning to end before I start writing. I do like a real detailed step-by-step beat line or roadmap, what, you know, you can call it whatever, but it is literally laying out the whole story. So I get, when I'm working on that, I get thinker's block. You know, that's where I run into the wall or run into a cul-de-sac and realize, no, this is not going to work and I have to figure this out. So I don't really get, if you define writer's block as not knowing what comes next, that is not an issue for me because I do know what comes next. That doesn't mean I'm always able to like write that particular scene the way I want to write it. So maybe then if I know, I might jump ahead and write something else. But I don't have writer's block in the traditional sense of not knowing where my story's going because I can't work that way. I need to know the story and then I need to focus on writing it. Otherwise, my brain is like split in half. It's like one half of me is writing and the other one is thinking, well, what next? What next? And it doesn't, I can't function that way.
Speaking of what next, what is next for you? Have you got an idea? Well, are you working on something else? Or
I have, you know, like probably every writer in the world, I have a couple of manuscripts that were written in the past and are sitting on a shelf gathering dust. I mean, I wrote 7 books, the Kubiak series, in basically 8 years, so I didn't have any time for anything else. But I'm going to go back to a couple of those and give them a good going through and seeing if they, you know, if I can do something with them. One is a novella. It's actually an inspirational Christmas story. And the other is a mystery. And it's set between a small town in Wisconsin and Minneapolis. And it involves two women whose lives were intertwined and then they kind of fell apart and then they come back together. And there's a whole mystery element in it.
Well, they both sound pretty cool to me. You better get working.
Yes, sir, I will do that.
And by the way, you have some appearances coming up?
I do, and I don't have my calendar right in front of me, but one is the 24th, I believe. It's a Wednesday. That's in Oshkosh at a bookstore that's part of the Carmel Crisp Corner, and that's at 4:30. And then in September, and that is the 26th, I believe, I will be Central Wisconsin Book Festival in Stevens Point. But that's going to be virtual. The one in Oshkosh will be live. The other one will be virtual because I'll actually be on the East Coast visiting my daughter.
A website we can go to?
Yes, my website is patriciaskalka.com. And I'd love to hear from people. There's a contact, thing on the menu where you can send me an email. In fact, that's how a lot of people do send me emails through that. So there's information there about the books.
Well, it's been a real a whole lot of fun for me to read your books and to have the chance to talk with you. Each time a new book came up, is it fun to do those? By the way, is it fun to do the readings and so forth, and getting out and talking to people, readers?
I enjoy it immensely. Writing is a very lonely occupation. Yeah. You know, you spend hours just by yourself in front of your computer or with a notebook in your lap writing, and you know, it's good to meet with colleagues, and it's good to. I belong to a number of different organizations and of course during the pandemic, everything was Zoom, but there's still something about meeting people who connecting with people who read the books and hearing their input, because it means a lot if you know, you spend so much time, you pour your heart and soul into something, and it's nice to know that it's appreciated or that it's meaningful to people or that it's entertaining them. You know, all of those things are valid. And it's just nice to connect in a social one-on or person-to-person fashion when you spend so much time just working alone.
Well, I'll tell you what, maybe you and I will have a chance to chat again. We'll see.
That would be fantastic. I'd love that.
Patricia, great pleasure. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your book and the whole series. And good luck with it and good luck with your next adventures. Thank you.
Thank you very much for it.
Patricia Skalka, her book that we've been talking about is Death Casts a Shadow. You take a look at it. I think you're going to enjoy it. Just looking ahead tomorrow, entomologist P.J. Leash is back to talk about the spotted lanternfly and take your other questions as well about insects. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.